From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, an actress who likes to break convention in her work and her life. We talk with Jeanne Moreau, the star of such French New Wave classics as Jules and Jim, The Lovers, and Elevator to the Gallows. She stars in the new film, The Summer House. Also today, sex and violence for the art house audience. We talk with director Abel Ferrara. His movies include The King of New York, The Bad Lieutenant, and the new film Dangerous Game, starring Harvey Keitel and Madonna. And performance artist David Kale performs an excerpt of his new piece, Somebody Else's House. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House is trying to send the message to the public that the president shares its concerns about violent crime. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Today, the president announced a series of grants for community policing, a move he says should make citizens feel safer on the streets. And he signed into law a bill to create a national database on child offenders. It's designed to screen applicants for child care jobs for previous convictions of child abuse and drug offenses.
This act will help us to take our streets, our neighborhoods, the institutions we rely on back for American values and American children. There's nothing more important than our government could be doing now.
In addition, the president met with the father of Polly Class, the 12-year-old California girl murdered by a man with a history of violent crime. Class said the president and he talked about implementing a national version of a law that would put three-time violent offenders away for life. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
The United Nations General Assembly has formally created a post to defend human rights and respond quickly to major human rights crises. The job will be known as High Commissioner for Human Rights. It's the first time in the UN's history that responsibility has been established for monitoring human rights. The decision came after months of argument over what limits might be placed on the commissioner's authority. Opponents argued that the commissioner shouldn't have the authority to initiate fact-finding missions. Much will depend on whom Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali appoints to the position. The leader of Italy's fastest-growing political movement, the Northern League, is being investigated on charges of corruption. Frances Kennedy has more from Rome.
The League began less than a decade ago as a protest against misgovernment and high taxes, and is now the strongest political force in northern Italy. It's seeking a federal system with greater autonomy for the wealthy north. The League's dynamic leader, Umberto Bossi, is renowned for his fiery denunciations of the corruption of Italy's former ruling class. But now he, too, has come under the magistrate's eye. Bossi is being investigated regarding an undeclared payment to the League of $150,000 from a large chemicals company. The inquiry into its leader comes at a crucial point in the Northern League's development. After being defeated in recent local elections, it's realized it must find new political allies ahead of general elections to be held next year. For National Public Radio, I'm Frances Kennedy in Rome.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 4 points to close at 3,755. Declines led advances by a slight margin in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 250 million shares. This is NPR News. Negotiators for Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization are set to meet tomorrow in Paris to continue their closed-door talks on implementing the peace accord. Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres said today that both sides believe they can overcome the remaining problems. The major issues that led to delay of the peace agreement include a dispute over who should control border crossings between Gaza and Egypt and Jericho and Jordan. Israel is also concerned about security arrangements for Jewish settlements in Gaza. An important commission has issued a report calling for the complete revamping of the government's program for medical aid for the poor. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
The report came from the National Commission on the State and Local Public Service, a private group that seeks ways to make states and local governments more efficient. The commission calls Medicaid the Pac-Man of state budgets for its tendency to gobble up revenues. Roughly half of all new state spending goes to Medicaid, the government program that finances health care for poor people. Right now, about half the money for Medicaid comes from the states, and half comes from the federal government. The commission's solution: the federal government should rebuild Medicaid from the ground up, add coverage for long-term care, and not make any new demands on state budgets without financing the cost. The commission also recommends that states take a leading role in health reform. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
An auto industry newspaper predicts that American auto production may surpass Japan's output next year, moving ahead for the first time in 13 years. Today's Automotive News said that U.S. auto production is expected to climb by 4% next year, while Japanese production continues to slide. The report noted that part of the change is because Japanese companies now produce so many of their cars in the United States. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The French New Wave director started making movies in the late 50s that broke many film conventions. Those films turned an unconventional actress into an icon. As we'll hear, Jeanne Moreau broke the rules on screen and off. Moreau starred in Louis Malle's early films Elevator to the Gallows and The Lovers, and she starred in Truffaut's Jules and Jim as a bohemian woman who was adored by two men. She also starred in Truffaut's The Bride Wore Black, Buñuel's Diary of a Chambermaid, and Orson Welles' The Trial. Moreau has made about 90 films through her career and is now president of the French Film Commission. The Museum of Modern Art in New York will feature a retrospective of her films in February. Now she has a new film called The Summer House, a comedy of manners about an exotic woman who comes to a London suburb. I asked Moreau if she identified with her role as an unconventional woman stuck in a conventional place.
Well, maybe. Maybe it happens. I mean, the way I was brought up and the surrounding, the family. It's true that once I've decided I would be an actress, then the doors opened up. It was not easy because my father was violently against it. And though I still have very close links with my father's family and my mother's family, it's true that I'm considered like an original. Mm-hmm. See what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Mm. When you did you mean your father was violent or just violently against
your
career?
No, he was violent. At one point, he was physically violent. But now, time has passed by, and he's not here anymore. And if I think about the way he was brought up, his background, a peasant family in the province of France, I understand why he was so violent and why you reacted that way.
Did he physically try to stop you from acting?
No, it just hit me, and I went away. Mm-hmm. That's all. But, and insults, I mean, it was a time when in his family, in this kind of society, being an artist, an actress was being a whore, you know, sort of. It was the equivalent of prostitution.
And that's why he didn't want you to go into the profession.
That's it.
You have a wonderful quote in the press kit for The Summer House. You said, "I have fought and shunned convention and routine all my life. Mm-hmm. Breaking the rules fascinates me." What are some of the conventions that you feel you've broken during your life?
Well, one of them we just spoke about, and breaking the rules, it's something natural because the rules have been addicted to make society calmer and better organized. The rules of marriage, the rules of all sorts of things. And as long as you break the rules but you don't hurt other people, it can be good.
Well, I think you've lived your life a step ahead of the times. For example, the first time you got married just a few days before you gave birth to
your child.
The day before. And
but that's not breaking the rules. It's just that we didn't want to get married, and then we complied because the families were so worried because of the name of the child. So at the last moment, we said yes, just to please the others.
and you've had lovers over the years who
well, I'm not the only
marry.
One.
Absolutely. But
I didn't marry each time. That's the difference.
Right, right. But do you feel that the times have caught up to you? That you were ahead of the times?
Well, it's a very personal approach to life. I don't know if things have changed so much.
Mm-hmm.
And besides, there are other things that... I've never been promiscuous.
Mm-hmm.
I just always let my heart speak and came close to people who wanted to be close to me. I didn't expect to be scandalous just for the sake of scandal.
Were there consequences that you feel you paid during your life, either in your personal life or in your career, as a result of having broken certain social conventions?
Well, let's see. Well, maybe at some point some people considered me as an outsider, but as I didn't mix with that sort of people, I didn't mind, really. So I think even if I had to pay some price, it didn't hurt me really, because deeply rooted in me was the belief that I had to be true to myself, or true to that inner voice. I don't relate only with material things. I don't only rely on what I see and what I hear. I try always to be very closely in relationship with my intuition and in what is beyond what is seen, what is heard, and what is shown. I believe in the life of the spirit.
You start in the early films of Louis Malle. First film. Yeah, like Elevator to the Gallows, and then his film The Lovers.
Mm-hmm.
You starred in Truffaut's early film, Jules and Jim, mm-hmm. and then The Bride Wore Black. You had been in at least one film before that, or in several films before that. Was it different to work with the new wave directors than it was to work in your earlier films?
It was totally different. In fact, I started filming at the same time as I started acting on stage. I'm from the stage. My only ambition was to be on stage. I had never seen a film, was forbidden. It was considered scandalous. I was not allowed to go to see films, and I was not allowed to read the newspapers. That's the way I was brought up, as you can see. It's a very, very, very restricted discipline. So I started filming, and I must say, the new wave brought about a total different approach, a total freedom. The old films I had made, I never met the director. I was contacted by the producer. I would meet the costume designer, the cameraman, and then maybe 2 or 3 days before the first day of shoot, I would have a meeting with the director. The directors on the set, besides Jacques Becker, who was not well known here, but was a great, great film director, they never give an explanation, never asked something special. And I remember one day I approached the director and I said, well, please tell me exactly what you would like me to do in that scene. And the man looked at me and he said, well, aren't you an actress? I said, yes. Well, you were hired to act. Just do it. So, you know, I was quite flabbergasted, because on stage in the theater, the Comédie Française was very, very different. And when I was approached by Louis Malle, at the time I was doing Cat on Hot Tin Roof, Tennessee Williams, on stage, directed by Peter Brook, very young man came to visit me with his two producers. And he was 24 and I was 29. And he came up And he explained me what sort of film he wanted to do. Very small budget, very small crew, hand camera, no makeup, shooting with a very light electrical group in the Champs-Élysées at night. Oh, I thought, God, is that marvelous? No makeup, because the big problem, I didn't look like any of the stars at the time. I was supposed to be not very good-looking. I had those signs under my eyes, a drooping mouth, and it took hours to make me up.
Did they try to make you look more conventional when they made you up?
Yeah, I mean, everything had to be erased. And when I looked at myself in the mirror, good God. And then suddenly, that was freedom. You know, just a base and a little powder. And I just had to look myself. That's all. And that was a great change. And the fact that it was a very small crew meant that there were no delays. We were moving on.
It must have been interesting to you to go from a family that forbade you to read newspapers and forbade you to see movies because they thought it was, trashy, and they thought acting was like prostitution. Now you were working with a director who was incredibly serious about film and who saw film as a great art form, as I'm sure you did, too.
Yeah.
Did that change your whole perception of the work?
I knew it must have been like that, but I do not regret the first films I did, because later on, rarely it happened to me to work with people that were less talented than all the names you've given, and at least I could be in charge of myself, you know. I had a knowledge of the camera, of the lenses, of tracks, of movements, and what was technically cinema was about, and I could be in charge of myself. But it's true that opening up with the new wave confirmed what I was seeking for. And there's something very, very strange.
What?
While talking with you and thinking about my father was violently against. In fact, now he's gone since about 10 years. I discover while speaking with you that all my life I always tried to prove to him that I was right. You know, it's funny. It gave me such an impulse. In fact, it helped me.
What, to take movies that seriously to help
and,
prove
and
that
it
you
helped
were right?
me that he was that he reacted so violently. It gave me the drive to resist. I resisted him. And now he's gone, I'm grateful. I thank him. He made things difficult. But then it forced me to go further, you know.
Further and deeper.
Yeah, and deeper. I wanted to be amongst the best.
Actress Jeanne Moreau is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is the actress Jeanne Moreau, and she stars in a new movie called The Summer House. In the second movie that you made with Louis Malle, The Lovers, there's a long and very sensual, very romantic scene toward the end of the film.
Yeah.
In which you meet a man, and after a little bit of like resistance, you the two of you just like fall in love and take a long
They make love everywhere, and they make love all night long.
Right.
And it's very kind of you to say it's romantic. Now it's considered as romantic, I mean, compared to what one is able to see in films. But when it came out in the 60s, it was considered a real scandal. There are some countries where it was forbidden.
Well, the camera, you know, it's very clear that the couple is making love, but the camera is on your face and on your hand the whole time. And through the movements of your hands and the expression on your face, you know exactly what's happening, although you don't see
it. I think we should go back to that nowadays. I'm fed up of seeing buttocks and things, you know.
No, what did you think of the scene when it was shot? Did you feel that it crossed a boundary that it shouldn't have crossed? Or did you think it was beautiful?
It didn't come to my mind. My main preoccupation was my relationship with Louis Malle at the time. We were lovers, and I was passionately in love with him. And so immediately we started the film, I had a very strange feeling. It was as though the more I would give to Louis Malle as a director, the more I would open up to that character on screen, the less would be left of our personal relationship. You know, you understand what I mean? I don't know how you call those things that counts the time, those strange little objects.
An hourglass?
Yeah. And I had the impression that as the sand was falling on the lower part, then the last grain of sand would be the end of our relationship. And I was right.
Why did you think that?
I don't know.
Acting out love in front of the camera as
because I was giving up something that was very personal and secret and intimate between me and him. Mm-hmm. And it's as though it was sacred. And I had the impression I was giving it to him as a film director to go exactly where he wanted to go as a filmmaker, and I had to pay the price. Maybe it's my Christian background, you know, Catholic background, but it worked that way. So I didn't bother to think about, is it going to be scandalous or what? No, I wanted to be as close to the truth, to the beautiful truth of lovemaking and sensuality, and I say sensuality, I do not say sexuality. Because the thing I regret nowadays, it's that sex has deprived our people who relate to sex of their beauties, of that sacred spiritual, beautiful glory of each human being, just to be considered like a piece of meat, a slice of steak. What is great in making love, it's that you mix both the senses and the love, and that's it. So I didn't think about scandal.
Do you think that Louis Malle had the same fears that somehow making the movie would end the real relationship?
Yes. Later on, we spoke about it. And he said that he felt the same. And I asked for something. Usually I'm never keen on asking things, special things, to be on the set or in a frame in a film. At the end of the film, when she leaves the house with her lover, she's in one of those old little French cars, and they cross the landscape. And on the left side, there's a white horse. And I asked for the white horse. Because when I was a child, my grandmother and mother, when they saw a white horse, they would spit on the floor and say, white horse, give me good luck to me, good luck to you, and good luck to every white horse like you. And I wanted the last image to be goodbye to that love, but at the same time, good luck to the white horse and to me.
Was it worth the sacrifice of a relationship to make a great film?
Of course. It was not a sacrifice. It was symbolic. Because no love lasts as long as that, you know. And we had a beautiful love, and now we are great friends. And it ended there, and we made not only these two films, but later on, he had another lover, He came up, and he asked me to play a part in another film of his. And we love each other in a different way.
I want to get back to your childhood. You told us that your father was dead set against you becoming an actress, that acting was like prostitution to him. But your mother, didn't she dance in the Folies Bergère?
Of course. She was a dancer.
And what did he think of that?
I loved it.
What did your father think of it?
Well, my father fell in love with her, maybe because she was a dancer and she was, you know. And she got pregnant. I mean, she married... She didn't marry a year before I was born. She married a few months before I was born. I think that she became a Catholic to be able to marry my father in the church while she was already pregnant. But you see, in the family, they always considered my mother like a strange person, a foreigner. She always spoke French with a lovely, adorable English accent.
And your mother was from England.
Yeah, she had been a dancer, and of course, I'm sure that I was part of the game between my father and my mother, because on one side my father was against it, and on the other side, my mother helped me.
Helped you to act?
She covered my lies, because very early I led a double life.
Oh, what did you do?
Well, I studied to be an actress, and my father didn't know.
Oh.
And I acted on the stage, and my father didn't know. He discovered it when he saw my picture on the front page of a newspaper.
Wow. Because you were in the Comédie Française, it would be hard to keep that a secret.
And my first play was a huge success, and I was on the front page of all the daily newspapers.
Well, he must have been mighty angry.
Well, he threw me out.
Where'd you go?
In a hotel.
How long did you have to stay there?
6 months.
It's a long time. Did you ever go back home after that?
No, never. But I made up with my father when I heard he was sick. About 4 years later, he was in hospital. And I went and I took him out. And after that, I always took care of him. And he spent the 10 last years of his life in my property. You would call that a ranch in the south of France.
Did he ever say to you, "You're actually a really good actress and you've made some fine films"?
Never.
Uh-huh.
Never. Never. He was proud when I had an official decoration, you know, the Legion of Honor and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But he used to say, "I can't understand. What has she got that is so special?" He thought I was a very good cook. That he appreciated. And it's true, I'm a very good cook. That was his limit. I had to do things with my hands.
Uh-huh.
And I did.
You're living in France now?
I'm living in Paris.
Paris. Hmm. Right. Okay.
I'm living alone. And
do you like living alone?
I need it.
There are a lot of pleasures in living alone. What do you enjoy about it?
The freedom to ask somebody to share my solitude.
That's very nicely put.
Yeah. That's so good sometimes, just to spread oneself in one's bed, get up at whatever time you wish. There are lots of pleasures.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. I really appreciate it a lot.
I thank you very much. And to me, it was not like an interview. It was just like a conversation. And I think I'm very privileged to be able to speak about things that are important to me. And I thank you very much.
Jean Moreau stars in the new film, The Summer House. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Jerry Gross with Fresh Air. Madonna's production company has produced its first film. It's called Dangerous Game. Madonna stars as a TV actress cast in an art house film about a debauched relationship. Harvey Keitel plays her director. Coming up, we'll meet the director of Dangerous Game, Abel Ferrara, who also directed Keitel in Bad Lieutenant. And David Kale performs an excerpt of his new piece, Somebody Else's House. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Israeli and PLO officials are expected to meet in Paris tomorrow in an effort to resolve their differences over autonomy for the occupied territories. This comes in the wake of a meeting over the weekend in Norway. Alfred Hermida in Tunis has more on the story.
The accord on Palestinian self-rule was due to come into effect a week ago, but it's been delayed because of differences between the PLO and Israel over the size of Jericho in the West Bank and control of border crossings. Speaking in Tunis, PLO leader Yasser Arafat said these differences remained, despite the discussions in Norway over the weekend. He said efforts to break the deadlock would continue, with further talks in Paris. The PLO is eager to avoid a further delay in the self-rule agreement, as it fears this will undermine support for the accord. It's accused Israel of deliberately playing for time, and has called on it to prove it's serious about peace by sticking to the self-rule timetable set out by the Washington Agreement. For National Public Radio, this is Alf Hamida in Tunis.
In Colombia, rebel groups have bombed a portion of the nation's main oil pipeline less than 3 miles from the capital. The bombing caused a spill of some 55,000 gallons of crude oil, most of which burned. Officials also say that rebels are suspected of killing a mayor of a town in an oil region, accusing him of misusing public money. An attempt by the South African government and the African National Congress to win conservative support for political reform is on the verge of failure. Talks with the right-wing Freedom Alliance have broken down. From Johannesburg, James Lorimer reports.
The government's chief negotiator called these talks a last-ditch attempt to get the conservative parties grouped in the Freedom Alliance back into the settlement process. The discussions in Cape Town lasted 10 hours but got nowhere. The government and the African National Congress want the Conservatives to take part in the transition and the all-race election in April to give the new constitution they've drawn up as much legitimacy as possible. The talks deadlocked because the alliance won't commit itself to taking part in the elections. The ANC has accused the alliance of not being genuinely committed to the process. The alliance, for its part, has accused the ANC of making unreasonable demands. The negotiators will meet again Tuesday morning, but they aren't optimistic about a breakthrough. The government minister says although a miracle is still possible, the talks are on thin ice. For National Public Radio, I'm James Lorimer in Johannesburg.
In London, police say that two small bombs exploded in the center of the city, but that no one was injured. One bomb went off in a mail facility in northern London and another near Victoria Station. A spokesman said this latter device was left in a suitcase at a pub. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 3.5 points to close at 3,755.21 on volume of more than 250 million shares. This is NPR News. German officials have announced their troops will be pulled out of Somalia by the 31st of March. That is the date set for a U.S. withdrawal. A government spokesman says the German cabinet has agreed on the date amid concern that German troops would end up trapped in northern Somalia when other Western nations leave. More than 8,000 U.S. troops have kept the capital open for supplies and guarded some links to German troops in the north. There has been criticism in Germany of government plans for an expanded military role in the U.N. In East Beirut, two people were killed and more than 100 others injured when a large bomb exploded outside the headquarters of the Christian Falange Party. No group has claimed responsibility. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
For many Lebanese, it was a reminder of the 17 years of civil war they hoped had ended. The bomb exploded during the weekly political committee meeting of the Falange Party, the largest Christian party in Lebanon. It was the biggest explosion in more than 2 years, with at least 300 pounds of explosives, according to police experts. The Falange Party has long been at odds with the Syrian-backed government of Muslim Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. The leader of the Falange Party and his deputy were supposed to have attended the meeting but stayed home with bad colds. The bomb also damaged many buildings in Christian East Beirut. I'm Linda Gradstein reporting.
Teachers at nearly one dozen Catholic high schools in the New York City area are on strike in a contract dispute. A union spokesman says the controversy is over a call for the school teachers to pay a portion of their health insurance. Teachers received only a 2% pay increase this year, and they say to pay for the extra health benefits would cancel their raise. Three high schools were closed by the teachers' walkout that affects some 7,000 students in the New York City area. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Harvey Keitel has become the mature woman's heartthrob thanks to his starring role in The Piano. He would not have reached that status from his roles in my guest Abel Ferrara's movies. Ferrara cast him in Bad Lieutenant as a depraved cop who deals drugs, gambles, and gets off on sexual self-debasement. Keitel also stars in Ferrara's new film, Dangerous Game. Keitel plays a director whose films about debauchery start to intrude on his life as a family man. Madonna plays the actress Keitel is directing. Dangerous Game is the first film produced by Madonna's company. Director Abel Ferrara has been called the poet gangster of the cinema. His film Ms. 45 was about a mute woman who, after being raped twice in one day, buys a gun to take revenge against men. King of New York starred Christopher Walken as a drug dealer back on the scene after getting out of prison. I asked Abel Ferrara what he likes about working with Harvey Keitel, the star of Ferrara's last two films.
Oh, man, you know, it's hard to describe what makes you really dig an actor, you know, and why you feel like, you know, they have the ability to embody the ideas and the emotions that the film needs to express. But, you know, for me, he's got it. You know, for me, there's something there. I mean, he's just so simpatico to me, you know.
Mm-hmm. I think he just really knows, like in dialogue, he really knows where all the accents and where all the beats should be in each line of dialogue. He's just so magnetic, you know, in the way he reads and in his presence on screen.
Yeah, because he's got a depth of emotions and feelings that he's in touch with that he can back up, you know, back it up. I mean, he's not saying words, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, you know, I mean, it sounds like, you know, new wave religion, but, you know, he's in touch with his feelings, man. I mean, it's that simple, but it's, I don't know, that's what acting's all about. Yeah.
Let me ask you about what is probably the most famous scene from Bad Lieutenant. In Bad Lieutenant, Keitel plays a crooked cop who deals drugs and keeps drug money, and he's also sexually obsessed. And there's a scene where
sounds like a good movie.
Yeah, there's a scene where he stops a car with two young women who are driving. I think it's without their registration. And it turns out it's their father's car,
right.
And they'll be in deep trouble if Keitel reports them. So he knows he could take advantage of them in return for not reporting them. So he asks one of the women to pull down her pants and the other to move her mouth the way she does during oral sex. And then he unzips his pants and masturbates while he's watching them.
I don't mean to laugh.
Hey, it's your
it's
movie.
Not as, yeah, it's not as bad when you see it as when the way you say it. Like,
well,
sounds worse over the radio.
Well, what we see is his facial expression. We don't see the part of him that's exposed.
Right.
But I think it's like the most compelling example I can think of on film of self-debasement.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about coming up with the scene and directing the scene?
You know, I mean, that moment of, you know, the power a cop has, you know, the power someone, or someone in a power position, as opposed to, you know, the person he's oppressing, you know, and that balance of, like, power and authority. I mean, what was going to happen out there that night, who knows? You know, I mean, the screen, Zoe was there at the time. You know, everyone was there. It's two young girls on a dark, deserted street. He's got the badge. He's got the gun. He's just gone through that moment where he saw the nun being examined, you know. he's obviously, you know, out there on something, you know, other than tomato juice. And, yeah, what was he going to do? You know, the fact that he never touched them was the real hook for me, you know. Because I know when I saw the scene going down, I was saying, wow, well, you know. Because when, you know, the initial conception of that scene was almost a funny scene, you know.
What was the initial conception?
I don't know. They would get out. In the script, it just said the lieutenant on a side street near the West Side Highway. I forget the line, but it was like he plays it out till dawn. In other words, they're out there. Anything could. They could have turned on the radio and danced in the streets. I mean, there's 900 ways that scene could have went. But, yeah, it went pretty hardcore, actually. That was, you're right, that was pretty strong stuff.
So how much of that scene was improvised? Most of it was improvised?
Well, we talked about it, you know. We discussed it. But, you know, you don't want to talk too much about what you're going to do, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, we're able to work with a certain kind of freedom because we just have the wherewithal to do those kind of things. And you know, you don't want to talk these things to death. You know, he's coming out there. I mean, he's the bad lieutenant, right? And what's he pulling him over for anyway?
So
he could care less if they had a registration, if they had their taillights. You know, what does he care about, you know, someone breaking the law? You know, he was on another agenda, you know.
Were you astonished when you saw what Keitel was doing in that scene?
Well, that, you know, I'm beyond astonishment with these guys at this point, you know. It was good, you know, I felt something, you know. There's also the point that who knows really what, you know, when you're seeing something like that the first time, I think, oh, well, you know, I was expecting something else, you know. A little more physical contact, if you know what I mean.
My guest is Abel Ferrara, director of Bad Lieutenant and the new film Dangerous Game. Both star Harvey Keitel. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with director Abel Ferrara. I think you have a really good eye for casting, and I think the best example of that I could give is King of New York, where the actors include Christopher Walken, Larry Fishburne, and this was before Larry Fishburne was the star he is today.
Before it was Lawrence Fishburne.
Yeah, right. David Caruso, who's now on NYPD Blue.
Yeah.
Steve Buscemi, who's become a lot better known since the film. He had a real small part in your movie. Giancarlo Esposito, who's since become better known. Really incredible cast.
And Wesley Snipes.
Wesley Snipes, of course. How can I forget that? So how did you bring together this ensemble of people? Did you know all of their work before?
Fishburne, we know him from Apocalypse Now, man. You know, we've been wanting to work with him from 1977 or whenever we saw that movie for the first time. These are people I knew. You know, I've worked with all of them before, you know. So to me, they weren't unknowns to me, you mm-hmm. know. To me, Larry Fishburne has always, or Lawrence Fishburne has always been a star, you know, since 1977. You know, Caruso or Esposito, those are, you know, Paul Calderon, those are famous people, you know, quote unquote, they're big movie actors to me, or big, you know, I mean, they're strong actors, and they're working actors, and the people I've seen and worked with for years, you know, and all kinds of stuff, even if it's just sitting around talking about films maybe we could never get off. Wesley came out of left field. Him I didn't know before that, but, you know, I mean, you know, you walk in a room with Wesley's, and I mean, you know, you have to be a fool not to cast him.
Take somebody like Christopher Walken, who's...
Yeah, that was the obvious choice. I mean, someone...
Yeah, no, I mean, he's a pretty well-known actor and should be an incredible star.
But he is. I mean, why...
Well, what I'm wondering is, I don't know how much of a budget you had on King of New York, but...
He got plenty for that.
Oh, did he? Okay, that's what I was wondering about.
Yeah, no, he got paid. But, you know, it's not saying a star. I mean, Christopher, I mean, how, you know, the guy is in all kinds of movies. He has a great body of work. You mm-hmm. go out to see him do Iago in a park, he's awesome. Right. You know, I mean, what more can a guy do? You know, he does, you know, even something like Sarah Straight and Tall. You know, I mean, the guy's dynamite. I mean, you know, what else can he do?
Now, how do ratings affect your films? I think Bad Lieutenant had an NC-17, which is the rating that basically replaced the X.
Yeah.
Did that hurt you commercially, or was it in a way a help because it said, oh, this film must be really different?
Yeah, I think it helped. It's hard to say, you know what I mean? Because you don't really figure out what makes people go to the movie. Or, you know, it's like the whole thing with advertising. Or, I mean, who knows why someone buys Coca-Cola instead of Pepsi-Cola? They still can't figure that out. You know what I mean? So it's like, I don't know if it would have helped or not helped, or if that film was rated R, it would have been, you know. I mean, it doesn't really matter the more I think about it. I mean, people are going to see certain movies, and an audience is going to come to a certain film, irregardless of what the rating is. I mean, you get a vibe about a film, so.
Do you oppose the rating system? Having had at least one of your films
what, the MPAA?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I abhor them. You get oppose them. I, you know, forget about my feelings towards them. I mean, it's like, you know, KGB time, man. It's like fascist America. You know, I you can't believe how angry it makes me. But I mean, how am I going to vent my anger by standing there and like defending the film, hoping I'll get a rating?
So, what makes you angry about it? What
makes it angry? It's an intrusion on my right of free speech. That's my work. I have one right. That's to do my work. That's to do my art. Somebody's going to tell me my art cannot be seen by these group of people. All right? I'm just talking on a philosophical level. If you really want to get to the practical level, if a film's rated NC-17, it can't play at one shopping mall in this whole country.
Do you ever opt for no rating, knowing that you'd probably get an NC-17? In other words, to not submit it at all? And are the consequences of that the same as having NC-17?
Of course. You can't be. If you're not rated, you're not, you know, I'm not talking about what you can do in New York. I mean, in New York, you could, you know, you could show anything, you know, somewhere you're going to get it shown and you're going to get the ads in the paper. But I'm talking about when you're actually trying to make, you know, it an economic reality that, you know, you're spending money and hopefully getting your investment back. You can forget about it, you know. That's the power of that board. I mean, these are, you know, these powerful, you know, restrictions they're putting on, you know, you're right in the marketplace.
So do you see yourself as having one foot in the art house and one foot in Times Square?
Yeah, you know. But for me, 42nd Street is the art house, you know, and you know, that's where it's at for me. These films play all places, all times, to all different audiences all over the world in all kinds of, you know, ways. You know, from television to videotape to this, that, and the other thing. So, you know, we do what we got to do, you know, and we do what we're meant to do. And then the life of a movie is, you know, for me, is a lot longer than the opening weekend, you know? You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You know, these films exist over a long period of time, so people see it, and they see it twice. And the same person who could see it in an art house will see it in, you know, in a drive-in theater, you know.
Abel Ferrara, he directed the new film Dangerous Game, starring Harvey Keitel and Madonna. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, today we're going to consider something that has been occupying the minds of many Americans lately, and that is violent crime, the crime of murder. We're going to have two pieces on murder in America, taking long looks at particular crimes, the individuals who were killed, who killed them, their families, their communities, how everyone was affected. We also are going to be talking to some settlers on the West Bank. We're talking to Nina Totenberg about efforts to fill the civil rights post justice. We'll talk about the NFL going to the Fox Network, and Bailey White has a Christmas story.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Writer and performer David Cale has a new show called Somebody Else's House, which is now playing at the Studio Theater in Washington, D.C. We've invited him to do an excerpt of it. In Somebody Else's House, Cale creates a dozen characters who explore their own lives and identities through relationships with others, by living through others, in fantasies, or even in the mirror. They range from Martin, an Irishman struggling with the bottle, his marriage, God, and the devil, to Sissy, a young man who fashions his existence based on Sissy Spacek and the movie Badlands, which he's just seen, to Tommy, a woman who believes she's a man living in a woman's body. In this excerpt, called Something Real, we meet Dorothy, a British woman in her early 40s.
You probably want to ask me about my affair with Leonard Cohen. Let me say off the bat, I really don't like doing interviews. That being a given, not many people realize that Leonard wrote Suzanne about me. The song was originally called Dorothy, my name. Leonard felt it was too much of a mouthful, so he changed it. Poetic license on his part, I suppose. It's just as well. The rumor mill in this SRO would have been grinding with me in it. When I met Mr. Cohen, he was just a struggling, up-and-coming, brilliant bisexual poet who had a tendency towards excessive verbiage and lyric melancholia. I liked him immediately. He possessed that combination of little boy sweetness and pure masochism that will always be my undoing. I had casually gone backstage at a poetry reading, along with a whole slew of literary aficionados. Leonard noticed me right away. The look that went between us was so intense. I tell you, the rest of the room disappeared. Our eyes locked like handcuffs. Destiny was working overtime. He inquired if I'd eaten. Said there was a little health food bistro that he'd like to frequent. Would I care for a bran muffin and a lemon zinger? 20 minutes later, health food was but a memory, and we were rolling around on the dressing room floor, engaged in what I can only describe as a bizarre extension of 69. Well, thank God I had taken that evening course in yoga at the Young Men's Christian Association. Leonard was, above all, drawn to my gallows humour, combined with my positive outlook on life. If I had a dollar for every time I had to tell him to lighten up, I wouldn't be living in Shepherd's Bush, believe you me. And I think he'd also heard about the thing with James Taylor, and that gave me a certain... mistoire. Oh, I'm being candid now. He knew a little bit about it, but nobody knew what went down at the end. James Taylor. Talk about standing on shaky ground. He may have seen fire and rain, but I have seen a raving lunatic running around the house, brandishing a bag of razor blades. Don't get me started about James Taylor. Anyway, after he wrote that song about me, Leonard's career began to take off. He was on the road a lot. He would fly me to different cities to be with him. I was always in hotel rooms. Those concerts always ran over. He was never there when he said he would be. I spent most of my time waiting. Leonard's secret, only to come out in the lyric of a song. And then to have your name changed and end up being covered by Judy Collins. The final indignity. I never did trust her. I'm on the record as saying, never trust people that live in the clouds. And I'm right. But work was always first with Leonard. I knew this up front. CBS was running around him. I was in the hotel rooms giving reassurance, rewriting songs for him. The folk life wasn't all it was cracked up to be. I met John Denver on one of Leonard's tours. I was at my most vulnerable. John Denver wanted me, but I was loyal to Leonard. Besides, he had such a strange mouth. Too large, really. He reminded me of a frog, so I declined. But I did like that song of his about Jacques Cousteau. I said, I can't, John, but I will always respect you for that High Calypso song. I did, though I must say the Sunshine song left me quite cold. But work was everything for Leonard. I knew I'd lose him to it. It was in a hotel in Montreal. I said, your work is your love, Leonard. You don't need me. You're married to your muse. I can't live like this. I'm leaving. He said, hey. Which he often did. Hey. That's no way to say goodbye. And then he had the nerve to ask if I had a pencil and a piece of paper. It's true that all the men you knew were dealers who said they were through with dealing every time you gave them shelter. I know that kind of man. It's hard to hold the hand of anyone who is reaching for the sky just to surrender. He was just some Joseph looking for a manger. He was just some Joseph looking for a manger. How true. Oh, Leonard, you left your mark. I was just a piece of vinyl then, and you made the grooves. Now every time someone touches me, I start to sound like you. I should have left years ago, but what could I do? I've always had the willpower of a summer breeze. At the moment, I'm seeing Chris Isaak. He's a handful, but he's so young. I know he feels more for me than I do him. What can you do? The other night he fell asleep on my couch in his underwear, and I wrote him a poem, which I have with me, as luck would have it. Christopher. He comes to me behind the other's backs. He scratches at my hotel door. I tell myself I'm smarter than this situation. Oh, Christopher. Oh, Christopher. I see his face on magazines now. I watch him laugh on all the talk shows. I see his song climb up the charts. I don't belong in these hotel rooms. Oh, Christopher. Oh, Christopher. He has girls around him all the time, and they're always the same. He sits up the bar and kisses them, like some wicked game. The clever part. Oh, Christopher. Oh, Christopher. I don't belong in these hotel rooms. I don't know where men in the limelight are drawn to me. I think they see me as something real in the unreality of their lives, something to keep them in touch with what they were before they became what they are today. I don't hold any grudges, but I have to say, as lovely as you've been, I really don't like giving interviews.
David Kael, performing an excerpt of his new show, Somebody Else's House. He performs the show at the Studio Theater in Washington, D.C. through this Sunday. He'll take it to the Bayfront Theater in San Francisco this February. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Senator Paul Simon has given the TV industry a deadline. Come up with a plan by January 1st to curtail violence on television or face legislation that will do it. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Senator Simon, as well as Marjorie Hines, director of the ACLU's Arts Censorship Project, and our TV critic David Bianculli. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.